inner hall of life.
Welcome to the Inner Ho Uprising,
the podcast about sex, love, and dating from the perspective of me, Sam, one black polyamorous feminist hoe living in New York City.
And Akua, who of course still doesn't know who she is, but know that she's a hoe. She is now a therapist.
Yeah, you are a hoe. Yay.
And she's a carefree black bitch.
Yeah, you know who you are. This is season 4 of the Inner Ho Uprising podcast, and we are mixing it up a little bit now that our dear coho Rob is gone for about a year. Every month we'll be hitting you with 2 group episodes and 2 interview episodes. Group episodes means we'll be talking about current events, our raunchy ass sex lives, like me and Akua's hoe excursion last night. It was fucking wall to wall. Anyway, what else did we talk about? Oh yes, and your raunchy ass sex lives, in which we read your listener letters. But on interview episodes like this one, we take our fuck ick segment where we talk to cool people about cool things based in sexuality, romance, love, dating, all that good stuff, gender, and we've made it its own episode. So this is an interview episode, and today we're talking with Kim Oliver, who is a black disabled hoe. So if you're a new listener to the show, we have some segments here for you. They are as follows.
We have Bae of the Week,
which is where we talk about people who we find attractive.
Hoe of the Week,
where we shout out you guys, the homies, the listeners, the fans.
We have Self-Care Tip of the Week,
where we give you some advice on how to take care of yourselves.
We have Pay a Hoe,
where we beg for money that we desperately need.
And we have Fuck It,
which is our topic of the day, and we're talking about the intersection of disability and sex.
So if you guys would like to follow along with the conversation had in this podcast on social media, you can do so by using the hashtag Inner Hoe Uprising so we can see it, and hashtag Pod In so other people can see it.
What is the sex operator voice that you're doing?
That is literally my voice. And you guys say that all the time.
But it's like especially sex operators.
That's how I read.
Don't read like that. I sound like a child. Sound like a kid like me. If you want to pay us to speak at your school or conference about sex positivity, black feminism, and other kinds of topics we discuss on this here show, we would love to do so. So to book us, send us a line to ihupodcast@gmail.com.
All right.
Sometimes going forward, we're just going to skip Bae of the Week because these episodes are pre-recorded and we want current Bae of the Week. So
no Bae of the Week this time.
Sorry, guys.
Next segment is Hoe of the Week.
Mm-hmm. And we have Desiree A. What did Desiree A do?
Paid us.
Thank you, Desiree. Thank you, Desiree. Also, somebody named Michael paid us today.
Yes.
Two ways.
He paid us.
Via Patreon and via PayPal. Okay.
Like, Michael.
Exactly.
What do I have to send you?
Yeah.
Need some panties? What do you need?
You need some? Wait, I really would sell panties, though.
Like, I'm telling you.
Wild panties.
He went out the way.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Once again, thank you to Shantae from Flash Magazine for the dope-ass feature and article that you did. And then also thank you, Fahima, who was the person who asked us those questions. Next, we have Self-Care Tip of the Week, and I would just like to say stay strapped up in terms of condoms, otherwise you'll be knocking on Akua's door at 2 a.m. That's all I have to say about it.
We gonna leave it there.
Thank you for the assistance, Akua.
Always got you, girl. Always got you.
Our next segment is Pay a Hoe. If you would like to help sustain the Inner Hoe Uprising podcast monetarily, you can do so by going to innerhoeuprising.com, clicking the tab Pay a Hoe. You can also go directly to paypal.me/innerhoe. It's the same thing. It's our PayPal. You can buy some merchandise by clicking the merchandise tab on innerhoeuprising.com, and you can use the sponsor codes used in previous and future episodes, because when you support our sponsors, you do support us. And also now you can support a hoe on a monthly basis by subscribing to us on Patreon and receive perks while you're doing it. This is an easy way to throw some dollars monthly towards the show, because studios, transportation, and events are not cheap, and as you can see, every show is not sponsored. If you're able and you'd be so kind to visit our Patreon, which is patreon.com/innerhoeuprising, you can donate $2, which will give you access to private IHU gatherings like me and Akua's orgy last night, as well as our undying love and affection. And for the price of $5 a month, you can come to me and Akua's orgy last night. You can come last night. You can go in the past. And then you can see it on video, because our $5 a month Patreons get exclusive behind the scenes video content. If you would like to donate less or more, that is totally appreciated. So anything from $1 a month to $1 zillion a month. It's just a more consistent way to pay a hoe, pretty much spending what you would at your local grocery stop. No. That's not.
Groceries
don't cost
$5. Bitch.
I don't know.
But literally,
you go to
Rite
Aid and you get like 2 gummy bear bags. That's $5.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I was like, I don't
eat gummy bears, but yeah.
I really like gummy bears. That's the only thing that I could relate it to. But $5, whatever you spend $5 a month on, tell us on Twitter what you spend $5
so that we know.
Yeah, exactly. Because so we can write better copy for this segment. Now we're going to take a quick break to read a message from our friends and us. Do you live in and around New York City and have the desire to hang out with some of the dopest podcasters in the galaxy? Well, boy, have we got an event for you. On April 21st, 2018, from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. in Manhattan, New York, Inner Harlem Uprising will be partnering with our good friends Tea with Queen and Jay and some of our other good podcast friends to bring you Pod in Live NYC, a free party where you can kick it with some of your favorite people of color podcasters. We'll drink, we'll laugh, I might even twerk on your face. Or challenge you to a Millie Rock battle. Who knows? We'll see. The only thing you need to do is RSVP on Eventbrite following the link in the description of this episode. Remember, this event is free 99, so we will definitely see you there.
Now we're going to go into the actual show.
Fuck it. It's our topic of the day, and today
we are speaking with Kim Oliver, talking about the intersection of disability and sex. Kim Oliver is an unapologetically black as fuck person who lives with a wheelchair-ish case of multiple sclerosis. She's dedicated to illuminating her lived experience as a black, African, Caribbean, British, disabled wheelchair-using woman with a long-term condition. Yes, identities. She is also a writer, speaker, a self-appointed professional vegan food critic, a qualified personal trainer, and an integrative health coach. Welcome, Kim.
Welcome, Kim.
Hey.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I am wonderful. Awesome. I am recovering from being called a fuckboy, but anyway.
Off mic, we had called Kim a fuckboy, but like the nicest and sweetest of all fuckboys. With the greatest voice and the loveliest face.
Yes.
Thank you. And, you know, it's a shame this is a podcast because no one can be blessed by it right now, but, you know.
So technically, Patreon users will be able to see this, but you broke boys at home. No, I'm just kidding.
You frugal ass nigga.
You're trying to save your money.
You don't need a retirement. You need Patreon. You need us.
In our own.
Yeah, that's right. You need some of that money too. Anyway.
So starting off, could you tell us a little bit about multiple sclerosis, your diagnosis, and any symptoms that, you know, come along with it for you?
Okay, so multiple sclerosis in layman's terms, is essentially when your body or immune system attacks itself. This is how I describe it because it's the easiest way to understand when you're trying to explain the ins and outs of how the body works and how our nerves send signals. It doesn't really work like that for people in their minds because we don't visualize these things. So the way I always describe it.
I'm sorry, is it an autoimmune disorder?
It's an autoimmune disease. It's a neurological thing, but yes, it's classified as an autoimmune disease. And essentially what happens is that the immune system ends up being able to breach the blood-brain barrier. So we've got like a membrane that stops blood from going into certain parts of the brain, and the immune system is able to breach it because there is damage. Every function in your body is controlled by the brain and all the nerves in the, you know, the spinal cord connecting to the brain. If you imagine that and you say that, okay, well, there is damage to certain parts of the brain and certain parts of the spinal cord, it will mean, translated, there will be damage to, well, it's not damage. It's like there will be problems with communication for different systems in the body, different parts of the body, and different ways in which the body relates to itself and we relate to our bodies in itself. So what do I mean by that? In terms of being able to sense heat and not feel heat and being able to sense direction and balance and all of these things. So it affects your senses as well. Multiple sclerosis, and much like you know, any condition, multiple sclerosis especially is different for every single person. In terms of my immune system, it has meant that my immune system is compromised. So that means that I easily can get ill. So if you have a cold, a common cold, if I get the cold, it will be like Amma's out for, I don't know, a month and a half, but also with symptoms that come with multiple sclerosis. And the symptoms that I have are in my digestive system. So bowel. My urinary system, so the urinary tract, so bladder, so I get frequency, urgency, nocturia. So frequency is just that you need to go to the bathroom a lot. So when you have a sip of water, the nerve feels like, oh, you know, my bladder's full, and your bladder's not full, but you need to go to the bathroom. So that's frequency. Then urgency is that when you need to go right now. There's no, oh, let me hold it, you know, I can't. No, that means that if you're not at the bathroom, it's coming. Do you know what I mean? And nocturia essentially is frequency of going to the bathroom during the nighttime. So when you're supposed to be asleep. So the bladder kind of being active during those night times. So it's more, if you're getting up more than 3 to 4 times a night to go to the bathroom, this is a problem. It is interrupting your sleep and your sleep patterns, but you're not really supposed to. You're supposed to at least have time for the bladder to do the work the bladder is supposed to do and the body's supposed to do when you sleep, which is repair and kind of nourish itself and work out what's going on. So that's nocturia. I also suffer sensory symptoms. So numbness in different parts of my body, it changes at different times. It was numbness in my head and face and my breast area. Sad times. And different parts of my legs and my stomach and my back. And it changes depending on what's going on in the body. In terms of muscles, so ataxia, I think it's called, where the muscle coordination and strength is compromised. So in my legs in particular, which is why I have my trusty friend in the corner of my wheelchair, don't necessarily go in the directions that they're supposed to do. So as I said, remember I said that there are interruptions to the signals going from nerve to nerve. If you are trying to walk forward, right, that's a signal that gets sent from your brain to the muscle, and then the muscle is fired and it moves. If there is a problem with that signal getting to the muscle might not move even though you are commanding it to move, right? And that, one of the things that they say that can cause that continuous interruption and you trying to send the message can cause pain, but also it means that the muscle's not moving, right? Or it's doing something, or it might end up doing something opposite. This, please, I can't explain it. I'm not a neurologist, but these are the things that happen, right? So for me, sometimes it means my muscles do things I don't want them to do, or they just don't do anything at all, or they are extremely weak. And it's not for lack of muscle mass. It's to do with signals being sent. It's to do with the understanding and the communication between here and there. However, that being said, over time, what can happen if your muscles are not in use, as you know, or they're not using their full range of movement, if they're not active, it can cause muscle wastage. So they can start to waste away. Which is also something that can cause pain, and they can become stiff, which is also something that can cause pain. The reason why I was going to leave pain till last as one of the symptoms is because the things that can cause it are varied. One of the things that I think, for me at least, has been one of the most devastating parts of multiple sclerosis has been the cognitive symptoms. So it can hamper your ability, at least in my case, to understand what is said to you. It can affect your speech. So your processing is slowed down sometimes. Being able to find words, being able to pronounce words, being able to read with comprehension. And also, you know, that thing that we do in having a conversation, if the conversation starts to build in any kind of way, it's almost like the brain starts to stagger. And so you find yourself with issues in being able to communicate, but also it can affect your memory. So with some people it affects long term, some people it affects short term. With me, it affected both. So there are some parts of my history that are blank. So there are some people who I just don't remember. And, you know, there are some things that I just don't remember. And in the immediate, I have to write things down all the time, because it's like, and I have to put things in the diary. If I don't, from moment to moment, I forget what I'm doing, or sometimes I'll forget what I've planned or whatever. And this is someone, the reason why it's such a big deal for me is because I'm supposed to have a high IQ in it. And I'm supposed to be quite eloquent and able to express myself in all of these ways. And also I used to have a mental diary. I could memorize my schedule for the month, times, dates, places, addresses. And so where now I can't even remember what I said I was going to do in 5 minutes, it's a huge difference between how I recognize myself as a functional person for me and what this has done. So there's that as well. Fatigue is a major symptom of multiple sclerosis as well. So fatigue is not feeling tired. This is something that gets on my nerves having to explain to people, because people are like, oh, you just have a kip, have a little sleep. And it's like, well, no, it doesn't work like that. So fatigue is like, the way I'd describe it for me, the way fatigue feels is like, if you imagine you wake up in the morning, but you feel like you've been running marathons during the night. And not only that, but you feel like you're in quicksand and you've got some elephants sitting on your chest and your body. And you're like, oh, guys, this isn't comfortable. You know, that's kind of what it's like. It is it's a sinking, almost like your life force is continuously being just drawn from you and you're on the last dregs constantly. And so fatigue, the thing that doesn't help it, sleeping doesn't make fatigue go away. I can sleep I don't sleep for 14 hours because I've got sleep interruption problems, but that's part of the MS thing. But if I can sleep for a whole night and wake up in the morning fatigued, and the next night and still wake up fatigued and have the fatigue throughout the day, and then suddenly on day four, it's like, oh, wow, I don't feel as bad. Do you know what I mean? So it's not to do with sleep. It can be exacerbated, yes, by stress. It can be exacerbated by activity. It can be exacerbated by a number of things, emotional activity, all sorts of things. And also it can prevent you from being able to sleep. So although you are exhausted and dreadfully tired and drained, that in itself, neurologically, can have the opposite effect. So sleeping can actually be difficult for people with fatigue. One of the side effects, or for many people who have MS, is depression. I don't know whether, I can't recall whether that's to do with where the lesions are. I think for some people it's where the lesions are, and for some people it is just part of living with this thing that is extremely unpredictable and debilitating, that's different every day throughout the day. And another thing that can happen, at least for me, is that you can become prone to easily crying and easily laughing. Now, I'm a jolly person, so I used to laugh anyway, but the crying thing, I never used to cry. And now I find that tears. And so it can affect your emotions as well. Yeah, it's just a lot of stuff. It's a lot of stuff. And that's what makes it annoying, because it is so varied. And it is just so many things that you have to constantly be navigating all the time, every day, and having to reiterate those verbally for the people around you, or even for yourself, is exhausting. But at the same time, I think it's something that needs to be spoken about, because lots of people live with MS, and not everyone's MS is visible as well. So I'm in a wheelchair because of some of the symptoms that I have, but not everybody with MS is in a wheelchair. Some people are walking around on crutches, which I have done, and some people walk around every day, but they have these other invisible symptoms. And so it's something that, having to convince people that, you know, no, but there's all this stuff going on inside me that's terrible, is, I think, can be one of the challenges with MS. People say it to even me, though I'm in the wheelchair, people say to me all the time, but you don't look like you're, you know what they mean. They mean you don't look like you're disabled, or you don't look like you belong in the wheelchair. They've actually said that as well. You don't look like you belong in the wheelchair or whatever. And it's difficult to understand. So that's just a long explanation. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
No, that was very necessary, because I'm not sure if many people actually know the several things that MS can do to your body.
Can you tell us a little bit about the process of you being diagnosed and what your prognosis is, as far as you know?
How I got diagnosed, it's a hilarious story. At the time, it was traumatic and disturbing. I was actually in the US. I was going to interview for an internship. My lovely cousin had arranged this for me to apply for this internship at this PR company there. And within like 2 days of me getting to the US, I started feeling heavy, heavy nausea. And I just assumed, it's just stress. The nausea after 3 days got so oppressive that I felt like it was crushing me all the time. And I just thought, this is weird, but I'm the kind of person who just gets on with things. I don't take medicine. If I get a cold, I make brews at home. Like if I've fractured my toe before, fractured my leg, never went to the hospital. Then years later, they did an x-ray and they're like, wow, didn't that hurt? I was like, yeah, but you know, you get on with life. I grew up around boys.
That's that African and Caribbean.
Yeah. And also lineage. I had all brothers and I had all male cousins. So I was used to getting hurt. Do you know what I mean? Like, so for me, it was also a kind of, look, this can't kill me. Watch me take this pain. You know?
And then also just black women in pain.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Yeah.
That's also true. That is also true. That whole kind of man up thing is just, it's not good. But anyway, so after a few days of that, I was in the shower and I was trying to shower, turned on the shower. I thought the water wasn't running. I looked up, the water was running. It's just that I couldn't feel it. So half of my body on the left side, like the water was running, I couldn't feel it. Then I was like, oh, maybe I'm allergic to the soap or something, you know, because, you know, all sorts of things. I'm in a different place. Maybe the air pressure combined with me being allergic to the bar soap that's here, that's very basic. Maybe that has kind of caused my skin to have some weird reaction. So I was like, maybe I should worry about it. Don't worry about it. Anyway, let's get on with things. So it was sunny. I was in DC and it was sunny. And so I went to go to this interview and my head just started hurting. So these symptoms are building up, right? So I was having this extremely sharp pain in my head, just at the back. And I remember just thinking, oh, it must be the sunlight, you know. And I remember in the interview, by this time, it was hurting so much that I couldn't think about anything else. And I was feeling so nauseous. And, you know, I was still feeling I couldn't feel my clothes and things like that. So I was in a weird place. So I went into this interview and I remember the woman asking me something like, oh, I notice you're from England. Should I do her accent?
Okay.
You guys will laugh at me. Anyway, so she was like, I notice you're from England. And
that is drag us. On.
Drag us.
Anyway, so then she asked me, I'm not going to carry on because I feel like that was a win and I don't want to like.
Yeah, don't spoil it.
So she then said, so are you planning to move to the US? And because I was so in so much pain and so confused, what was in my head came out and what was supposed to come out stayed in. So I was like, no, I really hate the US. Like, I don't like it here. The food is terrible. And no, I'd never plan to move here. Why would I do that? So I didn't realize, sorry guys, by the way, but you know, that was the old me.
No, drag us, whatever.
That was the old me.
I don't care about this country.
We don't want to be here either. We don't like the food here. We don't want to live here. Why did we move here?
I'm not that person anymore. I've changed. I've grown to love you all. Anyway, so at the time, that's genuinely how I felt. But obviously I had my PR, because it's a PR company. I had my PR response ready. I was so disoriented and my mind was constantly jumbled that that's what came out. And I saw her face contort. I didn't understand why. And then afterwards, when I came out and I was trying to replay what was going on in my head, I was like, but I'm brilliant at talking. Like, I can sell dreams. I don't know why her face. And then I realized what had happened. And I realized also that throughout the whole time I was screwing her. Like, I was proper like, oh, screwing, screw face. I don't know if you guys
have
that.
I was like, what are you talking about?
Okay, yeah. Screwing, giving her a screw face, like a mean mugging
her. Gotcha.
Yeah. So I was frowning, my face was twisted up and I was cocked to the side because I was trying to navigate the pain. So I can imagine what I must have looked like. And I'm 6'1" and quite big. And I can imagine that when I walked in there with my screwed up face and my attitude, seeming attitude, she was just like, look at this mess. Look, how can you come here all the way from the UK and this is the attitude you're bringing? I can't imagine what it was like. Anyway, so after that, I kind of thought for a few seconds about, you know, how I was feeling. But then I just thought, you know, it will pass. By the second week, I started not being able to walk in a straight line because I hadn't told anyone what was going on because I felt embarrassed about it, to be honest. It's when things start happening to you and you don't understand why, it just, you know, throws you off. So, and also, I think I also have this image that I'm supposed to be indestructible, impenetrable, some kind of supreme being, which, you know, and therefore, if things are happening, it'll wash off. It'll just, bounce. So we decided we were going to go to Miami. And as we got on the plane, I'd begun to get a bit scared because I was in so much pain, I couldn't even talk to people. So all my cousins who just met me for the first time, I'm there with my screw face, not talking, not wanting to interact with their children, not wanting to interact with them, just because I'm in pain, I'm confused, I'm concentrating on trying to pretend like I can walk in a straight line, trying to pretend like I'm not feeling like the world is like this. And I've got this pain. So we got on the plane and the plane started to rise. All I know is that I felt whatever it was, the pain in my head started rising as well as we went up in the air. That's the first time that I thought, oh, maybe there's something actually wrong with me. And that's when I got scared. But I passed out on the plane, so I wouldn't know. Then they had to wake me up after the plane landed. And that's when everyone was like, okay, what's wrong with you? Because that's not okay. You know, you passed out. And I was like, no, I was just sleepy. And so, you know, it's all good. Let's go to the hotel party. So we went to Miami. And whilst we were there.
We was at King of Diamonds.
Okay.
Oh, no. No, it wasn't. I wish. We were on a beach hotel and I didn't get to leave my hotel room. I didn't get to leave for the 3 days that we were there. I was in the hotel room and I called my insurance. That's the first time that I saw a doctor. So this guy didn't understand a word I was saying. I didn't understand a word he was saying. First of all, let's not talk about the fact that he turned up in a dirty lab coat. And he just said to me, "You have virus." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And he said, "Take these." And he gave me two of those torn off label bottles and wrote something on it and said, "Take these," and gave them to me. And I was like, okay, I have a virus. Cool. I started being extremely tired and unable to. This is week three now. I can't get up. I'm in bed all the time. I can't turn my head to the left, all sorts. And it's time to fly home. At this point, I was convinced that I had a brain tumor or I had some sort of, but an acute brain tumor or a clot. And so this is in April 2012, I made my peace. I was like, you know what, I'm sad that I won't get to see my parents and my brothers before I die, but I haven't lived a life that I regret. Anyway, so I did pass out on the plane for a number of hours. They didn't notice though, because the customer service on that plane actually had been terrible from when I got on. They only noticed when we landed, and then they took me from the airport to the hospital, did some tests, ended up going for some more neurological tests a week or 2 weeks later, ended up in hospital again, having to have emergency surgery because my fallopian tubes had gone into torsion. And then from there, they just kept doing all these tests. They tested my eyes. They did a lumbar puncture. The doctor who took the lumbar puncture, I feel like she damaged my spine because, you know, when you're black, and this has to be said, and this is something that I did want to say, when you are black and dealing with medical professionals, often there is this approach that indicates their predisposition, A, is to treat you less delicately than other people, but also to see your symptoms as less serious, almost like you're there to take advantage of the system. So if I say that I'm in pain, okay, what level of pain? Just have some paracetamol. You're making a mountain out of a molehill, obviously. The reason why I'm saying this is because it took me to go to accident and emergency 3 times and get turned away before I actually got sent to the right department to catch that I had fallopian tube torsion.
And this was in the UK.
This is the UK.
Because similar stories happen in the US, so.
Thank you. So for me, it's like, they were saying to me, when it was time to have the surgery, they were like, we need you to have the surgery because the potential that your ovary could explode or your fallopian tubes go into necrosis and then you get blood poisoning and die, like, is super, super high. So they had to push me up the list. That is the day that I went, that someone said, well, actually, if you've been having this pain in the way that you've been having it, I hadn't slept for 7 days. I hadn't eaten. I couldn't go to the bathroom because the pain was so intense. And when I was sitting there telling doctors, look, I'm in pain. Look, we said this earlier, right? We said that, you know, there's this idea with black women that you have to be strong and you have to present yourself a certain way. If I am saying I am in pain, the fact that I'm saying it out loud means that I'm in pain. I don't need to come to you like these white girls and come, oh my God, my heart. And it's not to say that you shouldn't be able to be like that, but I'm just saying the way I was raised, I don't, that's not how I would present. I'm not going to go red in the face because I'm in pain, because I'm black and dark skinned. So you're not going to see that. When you're pushing me and I'm saying, look, that hurts, please stop. I mean, look, that hurts, please stop. We're not going to be like, oh my God, because that's not how I react. But it's like they expect a particular manifestation or demonstration of things. And if that doesn't exist, and even where it does exist, you see them mock it. So even where you see people going, ow, I'm in so much pain, they're like, oh, just, you know, we have to do this. Whereas someone else would be like, oh, you know, do you want me to, we can come back later. Do you want some more painkillers? They had given me that painkiller that makes people go loopy-loo. They'd given me morphine 3 times and I was still in pain. They couldn't touch my stomach without me feeling their imprints of their fingers. Yet at the same time, they were like, yeah, maybe go home. The doctor said to me, go home. You know, you, it could just be that you have ovarian cysts. So, you know, people get them. And I was like, I've never even had a scan for that. And also, isn't that a serious thing that someone might have that? Isn't that something that you would say more than just go home? Anyway, let's scan. You don't even want to scan to check to make sure it's okay. But that's essentially how I got to my diagnosis. In fact, I didn't get to go to a doctor to have, you know, that talk that you have before you know what you've been diagnosed with. I didn't get that. They sent me a letter in the post.
Oh my God.
And I opened the letter and I was like, this must be rubbish because no one does this. No one gives a major diagnosis like this. No one does this. They call you in and they say, hey, just
I've watched enough Grey's Anatomy to know that that's what they're supposed to do, right?
Exactly. I've watched House. Well, so it's what, 6 years? Oh, wow. It feels like a lifetime ago. It's weird. When you get these diagnoses, your life completely, well, mine at least, transformed. I was doing so much stuff before I started. I was singing, I was doing projects and running shows and studying and all of this stuff at the same time and helping.
Well, let's
manage the artist.
Let's get into why we're really here and talk about how your dating life has transformed. Hey.
How are you hoeing, Kim?
How has the hoe in you changed?
Has the hoe in me changed? So, and I think that's what I was getting into, right? So when your life transforms in such a way, what you find is that the way you perceive yourself changes as well. How you perceive yourself with that change is crucial to how you then interact with other people. So for me, and I'm sure this is the case for some other people who were not necessarily born disabled, but became disabled at a later date, maybe in their adulthood. I think it's maybe a bit different if you become disabled in your childhood, because children adapt to things really quickly and learn ways of coping that actually are a lot healthier than the way adults can learn ways of coping, right? When things happen to us, when we get heartbroken, we want to go and break someone else's heart and do all sorts of rubbish. Anyway,
we're fucked up.
So for me, I no longer knew who I was. I couldn't see myself in the same way. I'm, as I said to you, I'm tall, I'm formidable. When I walk into a room, you know I'm there. I was also very sure of my physical strength just because, you know, I grew up fighting. So I was always very sure of those things. And suddenly to be turned into this kind of feeble, unable to move or pick things up, unable to even control what I did, how I did it, when I did it, my own bladder, having people having to do things for you, and the humiliation that you experience when people treat you or treat your body as if it's not a sacred thing and treat you like meat, and that whole kind of other people, your friends, your family, how they react to the situation can seriously affect the way that you feel about yourself. Just from a physical point of view, being in a wheelchair and dating or trying to date, there are so many barriers. So one of the main barriers, obviously, is people's perceptions. People have a lot of trouble being able to look at someone who is disabled or has a physical disability or has something that is outside of their norm, right? But especially when it comes to wheelchairs, and I guess maybe other people who have other mobility aids, maybe they experience this as well. But in my case, it's that almost avoidance, fear, They physically become anxious. So even the people who would be, let's say, in your dating pool, it becomes narrow because a lot of the time you find that the people who might be willing to engage with you are people who, A, have either had experience or have loved ones who might have had been in a wheelchair or been ill or something like that. So they have more of an understanding of the humanity of it. And you're not an alien, and you are actually a person, and you are a woman, or you are a man still, and you have emotions, and you have feelings, and you have needs and desires. It's either them or people. What you find is you find people who are curious and are like, ooh, never, boinked someone in a wheelchair,
Have you encountered any fetishizers, people that fetishize you?
That would be that group. That would be that group of people. And there's also the third group, and those would be the predators, right? So those are you see someone vulnerable and or someone they perceive to be vulnerable, because not all people who are in wheelchairs perceive themselves to be vulnerable. I very much did and still do in a lot of ways, just because of the physical difference and how some of the experiences I've had. But there's that group, and they will see someone who they perceive to be vulnerable and pursue them and try and take advantage of that vulnerability in whatever way. So there's that side of it. And that is difficult to navigate because for even the in any of those groups, you find yourself being a teacher for the most part. The romantic element of getting to know someone goes right out the window because the first thing people want to ask you when they encounter you is, oh, so what happened? What's wrong with you? Things that are quite intimate, that's an intimate thing. I don't go asking people about their medical history when I encounter. So how many STI checks have you had and how many of them were positive? Like that's before you have sex, you say those things, but you don't. Okay, so has any illnesses in your family? Like let's go back the family tree. Like we don't do that. But when you have a physical disability, people feel more comfortable to be like, tell me about this thing that I want to know about, because obviously it will facilitate some part of me. And it's understandable to a degree, right? It's there, it can't be ignored, and it's different to the norm, and therefore there will be that element of, okay, hey, this is what I need to know so that I know whether I want to partake or I want to pass. And so you find yourself doing a lot of kind of education and being very understanding of their ignorance and understanding of their lack of understanding and understanding of their rejection and understanding. And you make all of these kind of adjustments in the world. And
It's a
that
lot of
can be
emotional labor
exhausting.
on your end.
Yes, I was going to say the
It's
same.
a lot. And it's not, the thing is, like, I'm talking about it in the context of dating, but you do this in every relationship in your life. And constantly, it's a constant thing. And for a lot of people, because they're not in your body, it's continuous, so that's one side of things in terms of the interpersonal. But the other thing about being a wheelchair user is the limited options of venues. Like, I cannot tell you the number of places that I would like to go, but don't have wheelchair access. There's no wheelchair access. You can't get to them, even in terms of. So, wheelchair access is not just being able to get into a venue and being able to go to a bathroom, or it's also having wide enough doors for your wheelchairs to go through. It's wide enough gangways, being able to get past chairs. It's being able to park close to the venue. It's access to public transport. In London, most of the tube stations are not accessible. So, for a lot of people who they're trying to change that, but how long that's going to take, I can't talk about. But people who have wheelchairs, and you will then have to drive in. So, can you afford to take a cab all the way from North London to Central London, or South London into Central, or North to South? Can you drive? And if you drive, where can you park? Because you can't park in certain parts of Central London. So, how far is the distance from where you need to park to where you need to go? If you have fatigue, can you wheel yourself? If you can't wheel yourself, then you need someone to wheel you. Do you have a carer? Will the person who you're going on a date with be willing to wheel you? I don't know. You guys call it blocks, 20 blocks down the road, navigating the terrible pavements of London to get you to the venue. When you get there, will they have to look for a ramp? It's all of these things and things people don't really think about when they just want to go. They just want to go for a drink. Do you know what I mean? And so it's like all of this planning. And so from being casual, none of your initial interactions for the most part can be just casual and spontaneous. Because so much planning needs to go into it. And it's you know, in that sense, it can be restrictive in terms of finance, because there are a lot of people who are disabled who cannot work full-time jobs. And so all of these factors come into it in terms of transportation and petrol and all of these things. Can they even afford to go to these places to meet these people? Because you don't want people coming to your house when you're vulnerable straight away, because you don't know what's going to happen. And it's not like you can have your parent there or your guardian there or whatever whilst you're having a date. Like, it just, you know, so it becomes a bit of a problem. And so even where you are seeing someone, spontaneity becomes a thing, because, you know, before I became disabled, I could wake up in the morning, I could, or, you know, meet someone and be like, oh, let's go in there, or let's go here, or should we do something this evening? And it's, you can't necessarily do those things. Do you know what I mean? And that can a damper on how someone views the interaction. They may like you, but all of the effort that they'd have to put into being considerate of the fact that your needs are different, and the fact that the world around you isn't built to just accommodate your needs, can be a major block for some people. And also, even where they think they've thought of access, I've been on dates where someone's like, no, checked out, wheelchair accessible, and we've gotten there and there's a step to get in and steps to get, and they're like, because you're walking, you don't think of these things, you just think, oh no, it's flat, you know, because a step to you is nothing. But to a wheelchair user, that's the difference between being able to access somewhere or not. And not everybody is strong enough to lift up a wheelchair, and that's not even safe. There's that side of it. But also, there's the physical side of things. When you're walking down the street, if you're walking down the street with someone, you want to hold hands, right? If you're in a wheelchair, you're either wheeling or someone is having to wheel you. So that means either one of two things are going to have to happen if you want to hold hands. Either you'll have an electronic wheelchair. I do not. I have a manual wheelchair. So it's either someone else is going to have to come and push you so that you can hold the hand of the person that you're dating, or they're going to be the person pushing you. So all your conversations are going to be you here, them behind you, talking to you. Those kinds of things, in terms of when you want to give people hugs, they're having to bend down. And for some people, it's awkward. They want to put their arm around you, but the wheelchair back is in the way. Do you know what I mean? It's all of these interaction things as well that become different. And so it's people kind of getting to grips with that and encountering people that will get to grips with that. And what does that mean? Does that mean then you have to compromise on who you would like to talk to? Does that mean you have to compromise on interacting with people who you're attracted to, and just interact with people who want to interact with you? Yeah, so you make all of these compromises. You end up thinking about, well, I initially started making these compromises. It's okay, who's interested in me? Not necessarily the people that I want, but whoever is willing to accept and whoever is willing to deal with.
So how do you find suitors now? Like, do you use dating apps? Are you going after the people you're interested in?
I have been on a journey of kind of rediscovering myself and learning who I am and learning what I deserve, and learning that actually I don't have to apologize for anything. And I don't have to excuse what has happened to me anymore. I am no less than any other woman or person who is able-bodied and maybe doesn't have a condition. And because I've reached that point, I am in a place where I feel like you need to prove yourself to me. Like,
yes, Kim.
I am amazing. Like, as people go, like, I recognize how awesome I am. And being able to even say it openly and feel no way about it is a big deal. I don't know if I'd have felt this way had I not had nothing to lose. I don't think I would have gotten to the point where I realized that people had everything to gain. Do you know what I mean? From interacting with me. So for me now, it's a case of, well, I don't have to settle. I refuse to settle, because I don't think, what would I be settling for? What unhappiness? Settling for what? Somebody to just treat me badly. And I've been in those situations in this 6 years. I've been in abusive relationships. I've been sexually assaulted. I've been in, like, really horrible situations. And so perhaps it's those things that have helped me to be like, well, actually, is any of this worth it? All this compromising that you do and all of this doubting your instincts thing that you do because someone maybe might be interested in. Because, you know, it's not just what you think of yourself. It's about the people around you and the people who are closest to you and how they react to you. I've lost friends, right? Because they couldn't deal with the sudden difference and me not being able to be who I was. I've had family members and people close to me say, oh, well, you know, you're not going to find a partner now, like, especially if you want a black man, like, that's not going to happen because they don't deal well with illness, even how much more disability. I've had people say, oh, you're not going to get married now. If it was hard before because you were super tall and formidable, like, now it's going to be impossible. And, you know, all of those things. And so you've got to fight those ideas and narratives, even those ideas of beauty, right? And how those affect the way you see yourself. But now, okay, you asked me how I interact. I meet people when I go out or internet. Hey, listen.
Yeah.
Don't underrate internet dating. One of the best ways to suss out how trash people are before you even waste your time. Because I don't have time. I don't have the energy to waste on, like, you know, for some people, going on a date is a no-brainer. It's easy. Oh, if it doesn't work, it's fine. But my energy reserves are so minimal that I don't have the spare energy to kind of waste on going somewhere, all the effort it takes and all the days of recovery it'll take for me just from going out for 2 hours. I don't have the energy to waste that on someone who is a waste of my life. Like, I don't have that kind of energy. If you're trash, please stay away. Like, I don't, it can't work like that. Like, I'm not going to waste my hours. Like, it's not worth it for me. So internet is good because you work out who wants to have conversations, who doesn't, the kind of conversations they have. You can ask very specific questions and you work out quickly where someone's mind is at. Do you know what I mean? Depending on what you want. Do you know what I mean? So for me, that's a good place.
Have you faced discrimination while using dating apps? Like, do you post a picture of yourself in your chair?
Definitely. I do post a picture. Do you know what's interesting? Even when I was on crutches and I posted pictures of myself on crutches, people still had issues. But since being in the wheelchair, I find myself doing a lot of disability education.
More emotional labor. Get a Patreon link if you don't already have one and drop it in your dating app bios at this point.
They got to pay you for
exactly.
It's true.
The niggas don't get free work.
I was like, I don't know. You should be paying me for this. Because they were really like, oh, so, you know, what is it that has you in the, I don't know how to say it. Is it wheelchair, reliant, able? And I was just like, okay, so these are the different phrases you can use. This is what my reasons are. But not everybody in a wheelchair is paralyzed from the waist down. Not everybody in a wheelchair has this, that and the other. And so having to have those conversations is quite interesting online. But yeah, there are some people who just want to. Okay, so I will say this and I will qualify it. I think because people perceive there to be something wrong with you, it means then that you will accept whatever rubbish they're coming with and you will be desperate for their rubbish. So they will not necessarily approach you in the same way they'd approach another pretty girl. Because she is pretty.
Oh, she is gorgeous. Let us not get on Patreon. No, just see the picture that we're going to post of Kim after the episode. Yeah. No, get so on Patreon.
They will come at you literally thinking that they can just, because of the situation, they'll ask you about your situation, then want you to jump on their dick. Do you know what I mean? Because, oh, right, that must be really hard. So I'm not looking for a relationship. So do you want to, you know, should I come to yours then? Don't worry about the wheelchair. I've thought about ways we can use it.
What?
But yes.
Trash. Yes. Trash, trash,
are
trash.
Are there common kind of myths or preconceived notions like that you're desperate for love or that you're less attractive because of your wheelchair?
Definitely. I think I've even talked about this on my Instagram, like where I'm places. Sometimes I am places. So not just on the internet. People do genuinely believe that because of the wheelchair you're less attractive and therefore you are desperate all of the time for anyone. Now, I've been in situations where people have presumed that because I'm interacting with them means that somehow I want them. Now, guys generally think that a lot about women who are friendly to them, right? The way in which they make it clear that they have zero interest in you and you're not a woman to them is very specific when you're in a wheelchair. Very specific. They do not interact with you like you are a woman a lot of the time. So
can you think of maybe like a specific interaction that you can remember?
I was at a venue and my wheelchair, sometimes when I go places, I like to sit in high chairs because I like to remember being tall in it. And I also like people to recognize the length of my legs mm-hmm. and be like, oh my God, she's a goddess. Anyway, yeah.
She's an Amazon.
So I sit somewhere and sometimes people will tuck my wheelchair away or they'll put it somewhere else. And I remember being somewhere and I started speaking to some people and I was with another lady and some, you know, I love to talk to people because I love to learn about people's stories. And we were talking and this other guy joined and they were making all of this kind of, you know, flirtatious talk. And so they were, you know, talking and up until the point where we were ready to go, people started pulling out their phones to get my number, right? My friend was in the venue and I was like, oh, could you get my chair? If you ever saw the transition in the faces as they saw the wheelchair come and then back away physically, they backed away physically, their faces contorted, they backed away, blank slate, backed away as if they'd never spoken to me.
And they just left?
Literally. So it will be that, you might have that, or someone will talk to you. They'll see that you, I will always mention the chair if they haven't noticed it sitting next to me. I'll always be like, you know, with the chair, because I don't want to call me a catfish. I don't want to tell me that I've misled them. I don't want to have any ideas. This comes with me. If you are not okay with this, then pathways. And so I remember he immediately went into talking. At first he was talking about, you know, he's looking for someone and this, that and the other. Then I mentioned the chair and he was like, you know, just not really looking for anything. Just want to have a little fun. So if someone isn't, you know.
Like, nigga, what did you just say? What did you just say? Words.
You know, if they, we can have an understanding. Don't I like discretion. I want to be discreet. So maybe just at their house. So if a woman is woman enough to have that kind of interaction and has that understanding and confidence in herself, then yeah, that's what I'd be interested in.
Pure fuckboy talk.
And it's so weird about like people who exist at the margins and the intersections, like you're okay to have sex with me. Like mm-hmm. you're totally fine with having sex, but people we have to be discreet. Yeah. Like what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, of course. And I was in a relationship where I was kept a secret for the entire time. And I didn't know that it's because I was being kept. I mean, now I know it's because I was being kept a secret, but then they had all sorts of reasons. They were like, you know, they like to keep their relationships quiet because they don't like people talking about them. They're a Christian and, you know, they're an assistant pastor. And so, you know, it goes against their values and no one must know that they're having sex either because it depletes them spiritually. And, you know, this will look bad for their image. Oh, actually, that was very clear. Didn't think about that. At the time.
Hindsight. Sometimes you just want to have faith in people, you know? You want to give people the benefit of the doubt and shit.
I did. And I think also because there's a part of me that understands people's spirituality is very individual to them. And I mm-hmm. can't police that. Yeah. I might know the religion you're talking about in a very in-depth way, but how you interpret that is how you interpret that, and how you choose to express your faith is how you choose to. And I don't think I have a right to impose my ideas or my beliefs into that. I can express my opinion, but to tell you that you're wrong, uh-huh. I don't think I had a right to do that. Uh-huh. But it's an interesting thing. I guess all of this kind of stuff, if we want to talk about sex as well, like it becomes a hard area to kind of get into and talk about for some people, because it's funny, the guys that are interested in you or the women that are interested in you, they actually, women are a lot more understanding. Men are so rubbish. Like, it's almost like men aren't even raised to have common sense or empathy or compassion or any of those things, or even just be able to look at a situation and go, this is how that might work. They have to be spoon-fed everything. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, why do I even, I just, oh, mate. Anyway.
Totally agree.
Yes. It's like women with a woman, like you can present them a situation and they will at least reflect on it.
Yeah.
For at least 0.5
just
seconds.
Just be reasonable. Just be reasonable.
I'll talk about men because women are so much easier to deal with when it comes to this. They have less pretense about them when they have a hang up about it. They're more direct. Men will go around the bush and all of this kind of stuff. And then before you know it, it's like, well, actually, you weren't comfortable to begin with. You were just, you liked the idea of me, but then all of this other stuff was too much for you, but you still wanted to get your dick wet. Anyway, so I know that for some people, that in terms of talking about sex, most people, they talk about sex, they have dirty talk, all of this kind of stuff. A lot of people's dirty talk is around, I guess, rhetoric that surrounds, oh yeah, I'm gonna bend you over and then I'm gonna stick it in and I'm gonna ride me hard and then I'm gonna put your leg on my shoulder and all of this kind of stuff. And it's like, well, you might not be able to do that with me, because you know, first of all, before we get to the bed, I'd have had to wheel my wheelchair and then I have to put it at an angle that I can actually sit on the bed. And, you know, I can't stand over. You can't stand me over or something because my legs won't support the weight. So, you know, we're going to have to. Are you strong? Do you have good arms? OK, you don't. Don't worry about it.
Do you have upper body strength?
Exactly. Can you, the movement that you want to do, can you support my entire weight whilst we're doing it? Mm-hmm. Oh, you can't. OK, stop expecting things from me then. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so. There are those things. So, but when you have a condition, some people who have conditions, they have flexibility problems. They might have pain issues. They might not be able to support their weight in certain ways. So sex becomes a very, you have to know what the person's abilities are in that department. Some people get tired from sex. Some people don't have much sensation. I know at one point I couldn't feel my vagina. I was sitting on something, but I couldn't feel it. Some people's sex drive is depleted. Some people have pain. Having sex is painful. For some people, just the movement of the body can be painful and all of this kind of stuff. So it becomes a whole different world depending on what condition you have. And for some people to have the patience or the have an understanding of that without it kind of ruining their idea of what a heated sexual experience will be is difficult, right? So at different points, MS, oh yeah, one of the other things that can affect is sex drive. So for some people, it totally depletes it to the point where you don't even feel tingly down there. And also if you have a lack of sensation, it means what? If the sensation is muted, it means you'll require a longer or more stimulation to be able to warm up the engine. And those are things that need to be taken into consideration. Lots of foreplay, the way in which you treat me then stimulate my mind. But you guys, a lot of you are dumb. So you can't even do that. A lot of you don't even have the cognition to be able to have a conversation with a woman and not say stupid ass shit. So it then becomes, we have to rely fully on your physical prowess and your sexual prowess. And a lot of you don't like to listen. So most of you are terrible anyway. And they give it all the big talk. Anyway, that's another subject. Mm-hmm. So
I feel it.
We relate.
Yeah.
That goes into one of my next questions is that, you know, the myth that sex is spontaneous and those that have sex know that there is a lot of prep work, mm-hmm. To engage in sex. What is your like sex checklist or your preparatory behaviors for sex?
Well, first of all, before you have sex with anyone, you need to know their sexual health. You have to, like, for me, that's a big thing. Not just so for anyone, that's a big thing. But for me, because I've got this autoimmune thing going on and any little thing can cause me to have a relapse, which essentially means my body goes into crisis and I get a whole load of symptoms and things go wrong. And I'm in bed for weeks and people are having to wipe my backside. Like, I cannot afford for you to be coming with your infections to give me something and then I end up haggard for however long. So that's a very important thing for me. Venue. I can't just have sex in a park if I want to, because we have to get me to the floor and then work out about how getting, I can't have sex standing against a tree. Do you know what I mean? We're in the kitchen. We can't, you know, just be like, oh, for the cooker. You know, there are lots of things. Let me throw you on the table. Can you lift me up though? I'm 124 kilograms. Are you strong? Do you know those kinds of things? But so for me, it's like, okay, I need to feel good about myself. So that means I don't want to be sweaty and disgusting. So I don't personally, and it's that I feel sweaty and disgusting. It's some people like sweat and they like smelling with sex. That's their own. But my own, as part of my own self-esteem regime, I want to be clean. So I will go and maybe have a little washout because, you know, things build up and I'm sitting on my vagina all day. Like, there's yes. no air getting there. And that's another thing, you know, with people who are in wheelchairs as well, like for sexual health. Mm-hmm. If you have like things like a coil or things like that, it.
A coil?
I don't know what you guys call it. Like a copper coil that they put in the womb.
Yeah, oh, IUD. Control. Okay, mm-hmm. yeah.
So an IUD. So I have a copper coil. Mm-hmm. So mine doesn't release hormones. It's just the copper or whatever. Mm-hmm. But those kind of things can cause you to have bacterial vaginosis because it upsets the balance of the pH in the vagina. People don't talk about it, but it is one of the things that anecdotally doctors talk about if you probe them. So if you can also, because you're sitting on your vagina all day, it's getting hot down there and you're wearing things, you can also be susceptible to thrush a lot of the time. You can get... bladder infections because of the whole kind of bladder problems that you might experience.
I'm sorry, so, just to backtrack, thrush is the same as a yeast infection.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, candida. I think, yeah, the same thing. Yeah. When you're sexually active, then all of that becomes a lot more complex and you have to be on top of it because, you know, obviously for your own good, but also for the benefit of whoever you are interacting with. Like, I wouldn't like for someone to put their mouth on my vagina when I have thrush. I just don't like it. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's okay. Because then I don't want you to kiss me and give me thrush in my mouth.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. Yes. Like, that's the only thing that I don't care about you. No, I'm joking. But I, for me, it's like there are certain things. Also, if you go down there, first of all, BV is just, the thing about BV is just the smell, right? But I don't like the smell. So I don't want it. But I don't use all of these kind of washes and this, that, and the other. And also I always explain to whoever I'm with, these are the things that can happen. So I don't want to see your face screwed up. If you want to screw your face, go somewhere else to get what you're getting because the vagina is still good. So you shut your mouth.
And the boom boom's still good though.
So it's just a natural thing. It happens. Look, when you're pulling out your smelly, smelly, disgusting, listen, when try, okay. Next time you guys are going to have a sexual encounter, whether it's if it's with a man, if any of you are having sexual encounters with a man, before they come to you, when they're just about to come to you with their penis, tell them to go and wash their dick. Tell them. See how they act.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. I have done it. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a thing sometimes. Mm-hmm. Even telling men who come into the bedroom to go wash their hands.
Yeah.
It's like a fight.
Yeah.
It's like,
why
gotta
wash my hands, though?
Nigga, because there's dirt under your crusty ass fingernails that I don't want you touching my clit. You just touched that doorknob.
Like... the fuck.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. So for me, it's like those things are things that you explain. And if someone's level of maturity or understanding will allow them to understand them and allow them when they get down there to understand what's going on and what's not going on. So for me, those are some of the things. I just want to be clean. But also, as I said, venues for me are limited. Like unless I tend not to have sex unless I'm in my house, to be honest, in my bedroom. Like because my bed is the only thing that's the right height, comfortable enough for me to kind of get in certain positions without falling off. But also it's safe. It's safe, essentially. It's safe for me. And also other people's houses most of the time are not accessible. So you can't even go to someone. This is the other thing. You can't go to someone else's house guaranteed to be able to have a sexual experience in their environment. So most of the time people are coming to yours because your house is going to be wheelchair accessible. And that can also put a strain on things, on dating. If someone's always coming to you, it also means you don't get to see how they live and what they're like in their own environment. It means that they can live a whole separate life to you. Do you know what I mean? And so it makes it very difficult to navigate some of these things because it's like, okay, yeah, I could turn up at your house, but I'll be stuck outside downstairs. Like, it doesn't, not that I would, but I'm just saying, even if you wanted to do something spontaneous, you can't do some of those things. And so it's like, yeah, how many times can we really go out every week in order to make the venue neutral and you're not always in my space and not always invading my, you know, my nest? And so it can make things a little bit monotonous in some ways, but then if you really like the person, things aren't monotonous. It's just good quality time spent together. But for me, it's like, sometimes I don't want to have sex in my bed. Sometimes go to the gym and get strong so I can have sex somewhere else and you can hold me up. That's how it
Yeah, compromise.
But yeah, so fatigue and all of those things, but also self-esteem affects your sexual interaction, right? If you have a condition and you feel embarrassed about some aspects of it, or not being able to be flexible, or having pain in certain positions, or they can't put their penis too far in, or, you know, even for people with endometriosis, like some of them can't have a certain depth of sex, like it's painful.
What's endometriosis?
Endometriosis is like where the tissue that's supposed to be inside of the womb, do not quote me, check Google,
it grows on the outside, and it becomes
inflamed, but it also can cause different organs to fuse to wherever the tissue is growing, and that can cause pain, it can cause interruption to the bowel, can cause infertility, it can cause all sorts of things, and women are suffering with this thing. So I guess I say that to say that depending on what it is that's going on with you, like you can feel a way about, and by feel a way, I mean feel embarrassed or feel or not feel okay about what's going on with you. And so if you feel uncomfortable with yourself, that already can put a damper on the sexual interaction, because you set you will be the person who sets the tone for how comfortable someone else is with what's going on with you. If you're super confident about it and like, well, this is me, they have no other option but to get with the program. And if you're comfortable enough with that and you see them not getting with the program, you can dismiss them, you can halt the interaction, you can say, no, well, I don't like that, I don't want that, that doesn't work for me. But if you don't feel okay and you're not comfortable and you're not confident and you're not happy, that's when these compromises can come into play. That's when people can make you feel bad. That's when you might be coerced into doing things that you don't want to do. That's when you can't find your no, even though no is right here. That is where people can take advantage, and you can end up damaging yourself as well, physically and in health-wise, because of how you feel, because of feeling inadequate, because of feeling like, oh, they're doing you a favor by interacting with you sexually, because, oh, there's something so wrong with me that no one should want me, but this person does. So I guess I have to do this thing or do that thing or allow this or allow that, or they've asked me to do this. I don't want to do it, but I have to compensate them for their time and their effort. The other thing to be said, you guys asked me at the beginning how, you know, the wheelchair and disability affects my hoeing. Like, I can't really get to be the hoe that I want to be because, you know, of some of these things, and also fear of infection. Like, I'm paranoid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I am
rightfully paranoid. So. Yeah, that's valid.
Do you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. even having unprotected sex, which I have had, I do not recommend it, because I think unless you are with someone that you intend to have babies with and you know they are clear, you know, and you two, you are clear and you have trusting mutual respect and all this, I don't think it's a good idea. So for me, it means that those ridiculous or those spur of the moment feelings that you have for people that you might encounter or meet are mitigated by heavy policing of your thought process and the consequences for you. So it can dampen attraction even, like you'll be like, okay, but you know, is it even going to be worth it? So for me, there's a lot of pause when it comes to trying to interact with people in any kind of sexual way. I think the key thing for all of this is, I guess, coming to terms with, at least for me, at least, was coming to terms with who I was now and how who I became due to the circumstances that surrounded my health was different. And not better or worse. In some ways, I like to think that it's better because I feel like I'm able to be the full expression of myself now because I got to a place where I got so depressed. I don't know if you guys do trigger warnings on this thing, but, you know, I was so depressed and forlorn and lost. I had a lot of loss around me whilst I was going through my diagnosis. And even after that, I ended up having an extended hospital stay. I was in hospital for about 3 months in 2013. After that, I had a cancer scare. They thought, they didn't know what was going on with me. I was just bleeding urine. I was weeing blood and they just didn't know what was going on. I was on oncology wards and I was going by myself because I didn't want to worry people around me. And I'd started not to be able to see out my eye again, and my carers who were maltreating me. And I was just like, okay, do you know what? I actually want to die. I'm good. This is, you know what? I'm good. You know, this is, I feel like I've I've been through as much as I can take, and I'm at the end of my tether now. And it led me into being, I was so vulnerable that I was preyed upon. Because I was lost and I was hurting and I was confused and I was angry. I didn't know I was mourning. I was in mourning. I mourned for about 3 or 4 years. And also where you feel like you're not a person anymore, because I genuinely didn't feel like a person because I didn't know what defined this new thing, this thing that can't do anything for itself, can't even think properly sometimes, can't speak properly sometimes, can't do the things they love. I used to read a book a day. Now I can't even read a sentence and understand. I don't understand what's going on. Because of all of that, I didn't feel worth anything. And the world around me was reinforcing that. You can't get in here. You can't get in there. The way in which people will look at you and stare at you in the street, the way in which people who even know you will talk to you and change the way they interact with you, the absence of support and people and all of that kind of stuff can reinforce these ideas. And you will find, you can find yourself in situations where if you were in your right mind, you would never put yourself there or you would never allow for these people to get close to you. But someone shows you a little bit of attention and you're like, oh, okay. You miss all of the signs. So one of the sexual assaults I had was by someone that I didn't know. It was a stranger. It was a very, very bizarre situation. And then the other one was by someone that I knew. And in both situations, I remember not afterwards, I felt guilty. I felt dirty. I felt like it was my fault. And I felt like I'd sullied them, forced them into a behavior that wasn't natural to them because of how non-human I was. And if there's anything that I want anyone to come away with when they talk to me or anything, it's just that, listen, these things that happen to us, these conditions, these illnesses, they're part of what being human is, right? We have a body. Sometimes it does things that we don't understand. That does not take away from your worth or who you are. You are here and you are valid. Just because other people are ridiculous and can't look past their nose to see your face or to see your body or to see you and to hear you does not mean that you're not here and does not mean that you're not valid and does not mean that you're not needed. I remember I was talking about something to do with accessibility on Twitter and somebody reached out to me and they told me that their sister had at 21 had, okay, I got diagnosed at 25. This girl had her accident at 21 and it meant she was like quadriplegic. And she was depressed and understandably so. And she was in the prime, like at 21, what are you doing? You're in uni, you're partying, you're showing your body, you're, you know, doing all of those things. And she was cut in a lot of ways, cut down is how it would have been viewed. And in certain parts of the Black community, there is a lack of understanding of disability, of illness. There is this taboo surrounding it. There's this hush, hush, let's not talk about it. There's this, let's pray it away instead of dealing with it. There's a lot of that that goes on. And me just being visible and saying, hey, put on wig or put on clothes you like or smile, take pictures, look at my wheelchair. It's here with me. I'm a person, like I exist, and I exist as a Black woman in England. I exist. Like, we're not some ghost story that you tell around a campfire. Like, we are actually here and we're valid and you need to listen to us too and you need to recognize to us too and you need to be campaigning for us too. And we are part of, when you say Black, you mean me as well. You don't mean everyone who's able-bodied, who doesn't let the side down. So, but yeah, sex and dating when you're disabled becomes a very complex minefield of making decisions, and it's a constant learning process. For me, even forming relationships becomes difficult, just because it's okay when I'm okay, but when I'm not, I'm really not. Are you okay to wipe my backside? Are you okay to carry me to the toilet? Are you okay to bathe me? Like, that, it puts a whole nother pressure on something that should be a casual relationship. Because how would you feel then if you're saying, okay, you know, you don't want to give them that pressure. Okay, so when you're not well, they just shouldn't be around you. Is that how you're supposed to, how do you navigate that? How do you you know, deal with the in-between phase of a relationship when you've got a condition. Like, you, the responsibilities that we don't put on people till, you know, you've got a mortgage together or you're living together and all of that suddenly become immediate things and suddenly become things that you have to navigate in the early stages of a relationship. And it, I think in some ways, it puts pressure on both parties because I don't always want to have to deal with that. Sometimes it's not every day I want you to know the inner workings of, okay, so how many hours it takes me before I get tired. I don't want someone who I just have only been dating for 3 weeks to suddenly see me on my bed looking haggard and not able and needing them to help me get into my wheelchair so they can wheel me to the bathroom and, you know, then help me wheel out when I've just taken a big dump and then they can smell the whole thing. Like, I don't. Mm-hmm.
That's a level of intimacy you're not ready for at 3 weeks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And you don't have a choice with some of these things. I think when you're in a wheelchair, when you're disabled or when you have certain conditions, you have to get rid of some of those inhibitions real quick at paces that you might not be comfortable with. But it's also about the other person. How would they deal with that? Someone might really, really like you, but that is too much for them at this point in time. They may get to a point down the line where they'll be able to handle that. But some people early on, that's a lot. Do you know what I mean? And so it makes it difficult for them to get into something because they feel pressured. They feel overwhelmed. I've been in situations where people feel overwhelmed. They like me. They want to be there. And the part of them that wants to look after me is forcing them to be there. But the fact they're not used to this thing is overwhelming and causing them to act in ways that are quite abusive. And it becomes quite complex.
What's the last good old sex session that you've had?
The last good old sex session that I've had. Okay. I remember, this story might get me in trouble though. Like, anyway.
Good, we like it. Yeah.
And also, just in case anyone who knows me is listening, do not refer my parents to this. Yeah. They think I'm a virgin, guys. They think I'm a virgin at 31. Anyway, so I had a person, right? When I had gotten very ill all of a sudden, because sometimes with MS, like suddenly you'll start feeling terrible. And to the point where I couldn't, prior to that, I was on crutches. And then all of a sudden now I can't move my legs. I'm fully exhausted. I'm super fatigued. And this person had driven me home and opened my front door, lifted me out of the car with their arm, not put me in the wheelchair, lifted me up and carried me into my house, laid me down on the bed because they know that, and then changed me, massaged me. And then as they were doing the massage, you know, when the massage starts to get a little,
you know, feeling on the booty a little bit.
And then gave me like the most amazing head I have had in my entire life. Like the whole bed, like I'm a squirter. So like the whole bed was a swimming pool. Like, and one of the reasons why they did that was because for me, sex, actually, the endorphins released in sex help to relax the muscles, as we know, but it also helps to relieve the pain because of that. So where I'm constantly in pain in the muscles and nerves and whatever, it helps to relieve some of that. So that whole kind of continuous orgasm. Obviously, when he finished, I was dehydrated. I felt like I was in the Sahara because all the liquid in my body was gone. But it was such a beautiful experience. And also because it came out of that moment where I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. I'm so vulnerable right now, but also I don't want anyone to see me this way. And it was like he made something that could have been actually quite sad and depressing. Like this euphoric, first of all, guys, you guys didn't react enough when I said that he lifted me up.
We were silently snapping.
25 kilograms. Like, I don't know how much that is in pounds. That's probably over 200 pounds. Listen, I'm a big girl. Like, I am not small, innit? Like, this guy lifted me up. Okay.
I felt amazing. It. I felt amazing. It when you said it. I was like,
The fish. He dropped me on the bed. He placed me.
Yeah.
Just placed.
Care.
Like a
he took care.
Oh, the intimacy in that is just so.
It was beautiful and it was so lovely. And he didn't want anything in return, didn't expect anything, didn't try and get anything. Just kissed me. Was like, okay, cool. I'm going to tuck you in now. And then went about his merry way. My ladies, get you a guy that can.
Yes.
And if they can't, just make sure they can give you very, very good head.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And then go about exactly. their merry way.
Exactly.
I just tweeted that the other day.
Yeah. Be knocking me beautiful. On the head with your penis, like, okay, my turn. None of this.
Right, exactly. Can I get mine now?
Asked me to wrap up, right? Can I just say, MS has given me so much freedom in terms of what I can talk about, what I accept, what I don't accept. It makes you so open to being able to say what you want, what you don't want, because you don't have the time. And so in that sense, it's made me so much more sexually liberated, spiritually liberated, personality wise, you know, I'm able to just be the full expression of everything. So although it's all these terrible things that I said at the very beginning, and they are terrible and disgusting and horrible, in that there's been this open floodgate for all this other kind of growth and learning that has been amazing. So I just, that's the positive from all the negative, you know?
Yes. Thank you so much, Kim. You are a delight.
Yeah.
An absolute delight. Yeah.
You rock, dude.
can you just share your social medias with us so the people can follow you?
Instagram, it's the Kim Oliver, and my Kim is K-Y-M, mm-hmm. and Oliver is in O-L-I-V-E-R, so T-H-E-K-Y-M Oliver. Twitter, it's Tweet Kim Oliver, and Snapchat, which is the one I'm most active on, it's the Goddess K-O, so T-H-E-G-O-D-D-E-S-S-K-O. Yes.
Love it. Ooh, awesome. Thank you so much, Kim. That was dope as hell.
Thank you for having me.
You rock.
Thank you for all the work that you do as well. I think you guys are amazing. And I love you all. And I will marry every single one of you. Fuck enough money.
This is going to be a bomb ass wedding, though.
A large ass and a whole uprising wedding. We're here for it.
See you later, guys.
Yeah. Bye.